director of torture.
You ever listen to Kay Billy's Super Sounds of the 70s?
Quentin Tarantino directed the film Reservoir Dogs, and anyone who saw it knows what ugly business happens next. But in Iraq, torture was apparently directed at the highest levels of the Pentagon, getting to the bottom of interrogation techniques at Gitmo and Abu Ghraib, if it only was a movie. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, June 18th, and we're looking at new revelations about torture that have come to light from a congressional investigation. Also, the real story inside Myanmar, where political isolation actually conceals some good news. Some developments between Israel and its neighbors. Midwest flooding steals a future from some homeowners. And green with envy, sports fans who don't live in Boston. The Celtics win. That and all the news. Residents of Mississippi River towns in Illinois and Missouri are the latest to be dealing with flooding. In Illinois, Henderson County Deputy Sheriff Donnie Seitz says the National Guard is scrambling to control flooding after the river burst through a levee breach.
They've been sandbagging it since Friday, and it finally went over. It broke. It breached.
Officials say they had to rescue some people by helicopter. Across the region, there are fears that nearly two dozen levees could breach. And in Iowa, health officials are treating rashes on residents exposed to floodwaters full of raw sewage and farm runoff.
Senate investigators say despite warnings from military lawyers, the Pentagon went ahead with abusive interrogation techniques for detainees. Senate Armed Services Committee Chair Carl Levin.
You studiously ignored the memos from the lawyers of the services that came to your office. You studiously ignored them.
Investigators say some of the techniques were the same as those used on American POWs in Korea and Vietnam. Human rights group says doctors who examined former detainees from U.S. military jails in Iraq and Guantanamo found evidence of torture and war crimes. Physicians for Human Rights say many former detainees are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And Hamas and Israel have agreed to a ceasefire. The truce was brokered by Egypt and will start tomorrow morning. Hamas controls the Gaza Strip and says it's confident that all armed groups will stick by the agreement.
The Bush administration is asking Congress to lift a long-standing ban on offshore oil and gas drilling and to allow drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And 11 senators are urging the White House to file a complaint with the World Trade Commission against OPEC. They say some of the OPEC nations are colluding to keep global oil supplies down.
Well, oil prices are flat today. They are starting the day at $133 a barrel in Asian trading. The Dow opens at 12,160. The S&P begins at 1351. We're talking about women pioneers today. It's because Andrea Bernstein, our woman pioneer of politics, is joining us in a little bit to talk about women in politics. We also have a discussion of Amelia Earhart later on in the hour.
Yeah, and her first passage across the Atlantic Ocean. So who are the pioneers in your life, women who have made a difference? Who are they and what have they done? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Women pioneers, other than Adora Udoji and Andrea Bernstein.
I am the first woman co-host of The Takeaway, as
you
say.
That's correct.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. Torture and the chain of command. More than 4 years after the scandal at Abu Ghraib broke, which involved torture allegations of U.S.-held detainees in Iraq, we're still trying to get to the bottom of what is the origin of torture techniques and interrogation techniques and alleged torture techniques in the treatment of detainees in Iraq and Guantanamo Bay. Well, a probe by the Senate Armed Services Committee has found disturbing evidence that senior Pentagon lawyers and other officials were active in developing harsh interrogation techniques used in the systematic torture of detainees in American prisons at Gitmo and Abu Ghraib. Mark Mazzetti covered Tuesday's Senate testimony for the New York Times, and he joins us. Mark, how much of a surprise was this?
Well, it's a surprise because all we had really known up to this point was that these senior lawyers at the Pentagon signed off on these methods in late 2002 and even advised Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld to approve the methods. What we didn't know was that about 6 months earlier, they were kind of actively seeking out a whole new interrogation program, ways to get information out of people that because the current methods weren't working. So they sought out techniques that had actually been used and are still used on U.S. pilots, trained them to sort of withstand captivity. So these were the things that were kind of reverse engineered to then use on detainees in American custody.
So the model for the techniques that came up at the hearings yesterday were the techniques to develop resistance in American pilots. They would basically, you know, I guess you wouldn't say fake torture them, but they would try aggressive techniques out on American pilots, and they decided to use some of those on Iraqi prisoners.
That's correct. I mean, we've heard a lot in the last few years about waterboarding. Waterboarding actually comes from this program. It's called the SEER program, which the Navy has until recently used on its pilots to train them in case, you know, they get captured, and it teaches them how to withstand sort of the rigors of captivity.
Did you see the testimony of Irma Grainer, who is the mother of an Army Reserve specialist yesterday?
I did not see that testimony.
Well, here, this is one of the people who testified about her relative, her son, and I wanted to get your reaction to one of the things she told the Senate committee.
You know, it's a higher-ups. It should be on trial, just as well as my son is. But when they let the little guys take the fall for them.
She is speaking to the media, but there's this idea, and certainly among military families, that it is the little guys who take the fall on these questions of torture. How did the hearing make that clearer yesterday?
Well, it was, I think, the first hearing to really point a finger at pretty senior people within the Defense Department for involvement in all of these episodes. There's been more than a dozen Pentagon reports, investigations looking, you know, post Abu Ghraib to look into this stuff. And most of them have really sort of stopped the blame at relatively junior officers and enlisted people in the military. This one actually looks higher and does have some documentary evidence that shows pretty senior people were involved in developing some of the techniques.
Including Rumsfeld, right?
Well, it does not actually. There are documents that we've known about for some time that sort of showed how Rumsfeld signed off on some of these techniques.
Right.
And there was not yesterday as hard as the senators tried to get out of Jim Haynes, who was Mr. Rumsfeld's lawyer, what Mr. Rumsfeld knew and when he knew it. It was not incredibly illuminating yesterday what Mr. Rumsfeld's role was.
I just want to get that Rumsfeld detail. Go ahead, Nora.
Mark, you mentioned there have been a dozen reports, and there's certainly been a cloud of confusion exactly how this chain of command has worked in terms of the orders of torture. Isn't it a bit of a bombshell that the CIA and the Pentagon were actually working together in some capacity as opposed to working side by side or rather in parallel universes as has been suggested in the past?
Yeah, that was actually, I think, one of the most interesting things about yesterday and what we've devoted a lot of our story to this morning. It had long been thought that the development of the CIA detention interrogation program and the Pentagon's techniques were pretty much in parallel, but that there were sort of two different streams where it happened. But what we learned yesterday was that there was actually a lot more coordination going on than we had thought. There was specifically a meeting in October 2002 down at Guantanamo Bay where actually a CIA lawyer is brought in to discuss what interrogation methods work, what don't work, some of the legal concerns, some of the things they need to worry about in developing some of these aggressive techniques. So it actually shows there was a lot more commingling between the CIA and the Pentagon than we had ever known.
Well, Mark Mazzetti, a New York Times reporter covering the Senate Armed Services Committee hearing yesterday, it's clear lawyers were running the show, and we should point out that some lawyers were also warning against these techniques, and that also came up with the hearing. Mark, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thanks.
Those unforgiving storms in the Midwest, John, are continuing to wreak havoc. River towns, those folks living along the Mississippi River, they're bracing themselves because officials are concerned that at least 24 levees could breach. Already, the tiny town of Gulfport, Illinois, is 10 feet underwater after the river rushed in. In Cedar Rapids, Iowa, as we've been reporting, it is among the hardest hit by flooding. 24,000 people know exactly what it's like to run from their homes. The water is receding, but leaving just plain devastation in its wake. Mary Dickinson's been to her home twice the past week, and there's no good news, is there, Mary?
No, there's not.
Thanks so much for joining us this morning. Tell us what you found at your home as you made your second visit yesterday.
We tried to do a little bit of work in the garage. There was about an inch of sludge across everything. The water went halfway up my garage, so everything in there was destroyed. The entire basement of my home was filled to the top, and some of the walls have, the drywalled walls have come in, and most all of the ceiling down there has come in, has fallen in. Upstairs, we've been doing a lot of work in the house. Both of my daughters graduated this year and getting ready for parties, and so we painted the entire upstairs and just done an incredible amount of work in that house and you know, seeing the water going up the walls. And my carpet is very light colored, and it is just black, and the tile in the kitchen is just black, and we had about 2 hours notice, so we were able to get up some things in the upstairs, and other things we weren't able to, so to go through and see some very important things still in the wet floor, and it's just devastating.
So, Mary, this was a summer that you were hoping to be celebrating. Your home is a really special place to you. You've been working on it for some time, I understand. What has it meant for you financially?
We were outside of the 500-year floodplain, so, of course, we have no flood insurance. It will be whatever FEMA elects to get. I have spoke with FEMA in person, but they have not been out to inspect the house yet.
Do you think it's a total loss? Do you think your house is a total loss?
No, it's probably not, but there's going to be an incredible amount of work. Every speck of drywall will need to be removed.
So where are you staying now?
I am staying at my daughter's, my older daughter's house, which is not too far away, so we're able to go back and forth.
And you've been to the doctor.
I have been to the doctor. I have taken a medical leave of absence from my job. I suffer with depression, and this just kind of put me over the top. I had a focus this spring, and that was working on my house and was feeling much better. The depression was getting much better, and now my whole focus is gone.
Boy, Mary, tell us what it is that a flood takes from you, aside from the tangible objects in your home.
My home has been very important to me. I'm a single mom. I worked my way through college with two young daughters, and it's more of an accomplishment for me that I can have and be proud of and improve.
Mary, we want you to have that again. You hold on now, all right?
Okay.
It's Mary Dickinson struggling in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, looking at the devastating floods affecting her very personally there in the Midwest.
And we have a report from CNN that a second levee has broken along the Mississippi River. This would be on top of the levee in Gulfport, Illinois, that already has put that town underwater. More than two dozen are at risk.
The flooding continues.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253. Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning on this Wednesday, June 18th. And this morning, Maryland has a new member of Congress. Donna Edwards is going to the House of Representatives, giving a boost to gains women have already made in Congress. Today, 88 women hold office there, more than ever. Another record following the historic run for the Democratic presidential nomination by Hillary Clinton, whose campaign got more women involved than ever. And women who gave more money than ever, will that last? The Takeaway's political director, Andrea Bernstein, has been doing some checking. And Andrea, let's start with Maryland. What happened there?
Well, in Maryland, there was a primary back in February where Edwards defeated the incumbent Democrat and who then resigned. It was a very early primary in Maryland. So there was basically a year for this for the incumbent to be a lame duck, and he resigned, and there was a special election, and she is now will be seated in Congress and will have to run again in November. But she is what a number of women is hoping going to be a big bump this year in women in political campaigns. In fact, just the other day I was on a panel with Ellen Malcolm, who is the head of the Emily's List, which is working to get Democratic women elected to Congress, and she felt that the effect this year of the Hillary Clinton campaign is going to be similar to the so-called Year of the Woman in 1992, when there were Senate hearings that showed that this was over the confirmation of Clarence Thomas, the Supreme Court nominee.
Of course, yeah.
And what happened is when there were hearings and all America watched on television, they realized that at the time there were only two women out of 100 in the U.S. Senate. Everything changed in the polls in November. And here is Ellen Malcolm talking about the effect that she thinks that Hillary Clinton will have on this year's race.
I think she clearly has energized women. I think a lot of those women are going to get more and more involved in politics. It's certainly what we found. You remember 92, the Year of the Woman, when we ran all those women for Senate and for the House after the Anita Hill hearings? Women became energized.
And so some, like her, believe that this could be the tip of the iceberg, what we saw in Maryland. There are some other interesting races.
Right. And as a matter of fact, we're already seeing the effects. There's a primary earlier this month, a congressional primary, a five-way Democratic primary, in which a woman won in a blowout, which doesn't usually happen in a five-way race. And there's some very, that was in Maine.
Okay.
And there's some very interesting races to watch this year. In New Hampshire, which is considered a key swing state, Jean Shaheen is running against John Sununu, the incumbent. They ran against each other 6 years ago, and she lost, but now she's winning handily in the polls. In North Carolina, there are actually two women running against each other. The incumbent is Elizabeth Dole, a former presidential candidate herself. Kay Hagan is a Democrat running against her. She's behind in the polls, but the Obama campaign is targeting North Carolina as a big area to register new African-American voters. And
He did really well there in the primary.
And it's been a very tough state for Democrats historically. But if there is a big boost in African-American voter registration, that would certainly help any Democrat running in a local race there.
Talking generally about women, the energization factor in the Anita Hill era in 92 was, of course, this outrage of looking at the television and seeing how few people were in Congress. If Hillary Clinton is responsible for an energizing, what do you think the nature of the energizing is going to be? Is it just following her footsteps or something deeper?
Well, there's a number of very interesting things that happened in this campaign. One is that in some states like Ohio, 60% of the electorate were women. That's very high. In Hillary Clinton's campaign, more women gave to her campaign than men. And a very interesting factor, when she began her race in 2007, people were asked, should a woman be president? Well, is a woman qualified? Everybody always answers that question, yes. But then they say, is America ready? Which really gets to people's views. just a little over 50% said that,
that was
the beginning of the race.
Yeah, right.
Now that number is way into the 70s. So the country has clearly moved in its perception. And another very interesting thing that has happened, there's been this discussion the last 2 weeks about, was the media sexist, or were certain members of the media sexist in their comments and their treatment of Hillary Clinton? And a lot of young women have been hearing this kind of discussion, which was very common in the 70s, 80s, and even the 90s, for the first time. And so there's been a consciousness raising among younger women, and a lot of people are saying that that is going to affect how they vote in November.
And that's regardless of Obama versus Hillary. It doesn't matter who they support. They're going to feel much more strongly about going to the polls.
And then you throw into the mix the fact that actually in the last 20 years, the number of women in Congress has doubled, but the number of women elected to state offices has tripled, which then puts that many more women in a position to be considered or backed for higher office.
Right, and there are some more interesting races on a statewide level. There's a woman running for governor in Indiana. There's a woman running for governor in North Carolina. And there are some 30 open House seats. And in any of those races, which are close calls, this year, because of this energy, everyone is sort of predicting that those races are likely to go to the women
candidate.
Pioneers
all over the place.
Andrea Bernstein is going to have a lot to be following in the weeks and months ahead.
We'll be back
Thank
in
you
touch.
Very much.
Thank
the Takeaway's you. Political guru. And we're asking people today, who are the pioneering women in your life? And here's what somebody told us.
Hi, my name is Michael Beaver. I'm calling from Newark, New Jersey. And the pioneer I work with is Star Roxanne Hiltz. She's a pioneer in social networking and computer conferencing. She, together with Murray Turoff, developed probably the first distance learning computer program back in the 1970s at the New Jersey Institute of Technology. And she's been a mentor to many, many people and is an inspiration to work with.
Well, thank you very much for that.
Pioneers, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Now, headlines from Femi Okeh.
It's 28 minutes past the hour. Residents in Gulfport, Illinois and Clarksville, Missouri are battling flooding, and there are National Weather Service flood warnings for Wisconsin and Iowa as well. The human rights group Physicians for Human Rights says that former detainees from U.S. military jails in Iraq and Guantanamo are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And the Palestinian Hamas movement and Israel have agreed to a ceasefire. The truce was brokered by Egypt and will start tomorrow morning. Hossam Zaki from the Egyptian Foreign Ministry confirmed that both sides have agreed to stop fighting.
It will be a cessation of all hostile acts, all military acts from both sides.
Hamas, which controls the Gaza Strip, says it's confident that all armed groups in Gaza will stick by the agreement. Israel has also said it's open to peace talks with Lebanon and all issues will be open for discussion. And there will be some initial clues about what Barack Obama's national security team might look like. Senator Obama is meeting with a group today that includes top Clinton administration officials and former lawmakers. The Democratic presidential candidates meet for the first time today with what he's calling his senior working group on national security.
Speaking of Barack Obama, we should note that Andrea Bernstein, our political director, has a blog on our website about the number of women in the campaigns of both McCain and Obama. So
lots
check that
stuff.
Out.
I love that. Thank you, Femi.
You're
Thanks,
welcome.
Femi. The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to available at responsibilityproject.com, because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. As we've just heard from the headlines from Femi, two tantalizing stories out of the Middle East. Are they signs of peace? Are they signs of progress? Are they signs of, well, what are they signs of? That's why we want to talk with the BBC's Jeremy Bowen. He's the Middle East correspondent and editor there to talk about the Israeli government and the militant group Hamas. They're announcing a ceasefire today. And also Israel has just called for peace talks with Lebanon. Jeremy, thanks for joining us. How do you assess, first, this ceasefire between Israel and Hamas? How important is that? And then this call by Israel for peace talks with Lebanon?
On the ceasefire, first of all, the ceasefire, it will give both sides some calm and some time, which they need. It's also, I think, a sign of realism on both sides. First of all, the Israelis realizing that their other option, which was essentially to invade Gaza and to keep it under their direct control for quite a long time, probably wouldn't have stopped the rockets, which have been hitting Israel, which is the thing that they've been very concerned about. And on the Hamas side, there's realism there insofar as they recognized, I think, that they need to show people in Gaza that they can make life better than it's been. And one way of doing that is to try and take off some of the pressure, the military pressure from Israel, and also the state of siege which Israel has imposed there. There are now, of Gaza's 1.4 million population, a million people there rely on United Nations food aid.
Hamas did win the election, which is why they're in control in Gaza. Is this a sign that Israel, on some level, may be willing to accept a Hamas-controlled territory on their southern border?
No, I think they hate the fact that Hamas is there, but I think that they are accepting Hamas, at least tacitly, as a fact of life in the Middle East, which was something that they were reluctant to do. This negotiation wasn't direct. It was via the auspices of the Egyptians. They shuttled between the two sides. But the fact is, it is a tacit recognition, of course.
Well, and it's certainly in the Egyptians' interest because of so many refugees moving into Egypt since Hamas took over because of all the instability that you referred to just a moment ago. Let's move to the north. What do you make of this call for peace talks with Lebanon by Israel this morning?
Well, it's interesting insofar as Prime Minister Olmert has said that he'll discuss a disputed piece of territory on the border, which is called Sheba Farms, which the Israelis up to now have always said is actually, yes, they say it's occupied Arab territory, but it's actually Syrian, not Lebanese. The Lebanese say it's their territory. So that's one thing. Let's not forget that there's a right of veto in the Lebanese cabinet for Hezbollah, the group which Israel regards as a terrorist organization. It's also a political movement in Lebanon.
Well, that's recent. I mean, they realigned the constitution, and based on this agreement, Hezbollah has a veto. This could be the first test of that, right?
Well, in a way, but, you know, Israel has already, a week or two ago, suggested talks with Lebanon, and Lebanon said no to that. Israel is quite keen to have bilateral talks with countries. What it's never been very keen on is talking collectively to some of the Arab countries that are concerned with this. The Lebanese might say that there's an Arab peace plan on the table at the moment. You know, however, it's interesting. It will be interesting to see how the Lebanese respond to this and whether they think that it's something that they can run with. I suspect that because of Prime Minister Olmert's political weakness, among many other things, they might not be that interested.
And Jeremy, what do you make of Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice's visit to Lebanon in the past week?
Well, Condoleezza Rice has been one of the backers of Fouad Senioura, who's the Lebanese prime minister, who's pro-Western. I think that they are trying to support, the Americans and the West are trying to support Senioura and his people. But what's the last month or 6 weeks in Lebanon has shown is that the people who have strengthened their position there are Hezbollah and their, by extension, their backers in Iran.
Well, certainly that is what the next Israeli president is going to inherit in Israel. You mentioned a moment ago the weak sort of waning hours of the Olmert prime ministership there in Israel. How long is this going to go on in Israel, and what's likely to be the sort of successor moment in Israel, and when are we likely to see that?
There are a couple of different options at the moment. It's a question, one of the main major questions is whether Prime Minister Olmert's coalition partner, the leader of the Labour Party, Ehud Barak, whether he decides to force elections. Now, it's getting quite difficult for him not to force elections, which he can do. But the problem is that if there's an election, he'll probably lose it, because consistently ahead in the polls is the other part, the opposition party, Likud, and its leader, Benjamin Netanyahu. Barak really wants to be the next prime minister, and he feels that for him, his ideal solution might be to try to engineer a situation where Kadima, who are the the majority party in the current coalition, this Prime Minister Olmert's party, that they get in another prime minister without having an election. And the person being talked about is the foreign minister, Zippy Livni. Now, Zippy Livni isn't all that experienced, and Barak is hoping that he will look strong and tough and experienced and responsible next to her. So when an election does come, and it'll be, I would imagine, sometime towards the end of this year, beginning of next year, most likely at the moment, then that he will have improved his position and will be able to put up a better fight than the polls suggest he will against Mr. Netanyahu.
Jeremy Bowen, Middle East editor for the BBC, thank you very much. So those are the three takeaway names there in Israel to remember. Zippy Livni, an unfamiliar name, and two familiar names, Bibi Netanyahu and Ehud Barak, as Israel contemplates life after Ehud Olmert.
Now time for headlines from Femi Oke. Femi?
Hello again. 21 minutes to the hour. The Celtics win their 17th NBA title, the first in 22 years. President Bush wants Congress to end the ban on offshore oil and gas drilling. And a car bomb blast in Baghdad from yesterday was the deadliest attack in Baghdad since March the 6th. The United Nations reports that the number of refugees worldwide has risen to over 11 million people this year, up from 9.9 million in 2006. Nearly half of the world's refugees are now from Afghanistan and Iraq. Bosnian war survivors of the Srebrenica massacre are bringing a civil case in The Hague today against the Dutch state and the United Nations for failing to protect them. 8,000 Bosnian Muslims were killed by Bosnian Serb forces in the 1995 massacre. The Food and Drug Administration is sending out stiff letters to the makers of 25 products advertised to help cancer patients. The FDA is warning the companies to drop unproven claims or risk seizure of their products and possible prosecution. The oldest known recording of computer-generated music has just been unveiled as part of the 60th anniversary of a computer known as Baby. It was the forerunner of all modern computers. Here's the music in all its computerized glory. Pretty amazing. That was done back in the 1950s. Black Sheep.
I have all her albums.
You do? Yeah,
it sounds so primitive, doesn't it?
But Freedia, when you think it was done back in the 1950s in the University of Manchester, it's incredible that that's how computerized music started, and this is how it sounds now.
It's computer music as opposed to electronic music, which is a whole other thing. Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for that distinction, John. Appreciate it.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm a dork.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
A new concept in air transportation. The travail has been taken out of travel.
Actually, that's a very old concept, air travel without the travail. But once upon a time, a trip on an airplane was a romantic notion. It was really exciting.
And way out of bounds for most of the world.
Yes, that's right. But the romance of flight was the creation of a woman pioneer pilot and aviation innovator, Amelia Earhart. And it was 80 years ago today, on June 18th, 1928, that Earhart was a passenger on a plane crossing the Atlantic. She made history as the first woman to cross the Atlantic by plane. But this would not be her last crossing of an ocean. I don't know. A few years later, she flew herself in 1932 right across the pond.
I believe I saw land first about the middle. I decided to come down anyway in the best available pasture. I got down without any trouble and taxied to the front door of a surprised farmer cottage.
Available pasture.
And think how new aviation was back then. And here she is, cool, calm, and collected, talking about coming down in a field. She'd wanted to make it to Paris, but was forced to land after 20 hours and 40 minutes and 2,000 miles in Wales. But here she is talking about flying as a marvel, as a scientific phenomenon.
Among all the marvels of modern invention, that with which I am most concerned is, of course, air transportation. Flying is perhaps the most dramatic of recent scientific attainments.
Yeah, and women are right in the middle of it.
She was a pioneer, not just flying, but the business of it.
That's true. I mean, you know, the thing that's interesting is that she evokes a time when women were involved in all aspects of this emerging new industry, this emerging new science. And you can hear her talking about the role of women back in the mid-1930s.
Aviation, this young modern giant, exemplifies the possible relationship of women and the creations of science. Although women as yet have not taken full advantage of its use and benefits, air travel is as available to them as to men. As so often happens in introducing the new or changing the old, public acceptance depends peculiarly upon women's friendly attitude. In aviation, they are arbiters of whether or not their families shall fly, and as such are a potent influence.
If the airline industry had paid more attention to that, they'd probably be in better shape today.
Well, she was truly a Renaissance woman. She promoted the role of women in the field, as we just heard, and she even used her position as an editor at Cosmopolitan magazine to advance that goal. She was in media. She was in science. She was in the air.
She was a,
couldn't stop Amelia Earhart.
She was a partner in the company that became TWA. She was the first person to fly solo from the Honolulu to Oakland across the Pacific. And on June 1st, 1937, she and her navigator, Fred Noonan, departed on a 29,000-mile journey. They thought it would be a trip around the world, the first for a woman, but then this happened.
Legendary aviatrix Amelia Earhart is reported missing. The director of three aeronautical companies, she was the first woman to cross the Atlantic, and in 1932, the first woman to cross it solo in record time.
She disappeared somewhere over the Central Pacific Ocean. Her remains have never been found.
And she would be terribly disappointed today by the fact that women represent only 6% of the total pilot population in the U.S. and slightly more than 18% of non-pilot aviation employees.
80 years ago today, she hopped on a plane, Amelia Earhart did, and became the first woman to cross the Atlantic. Today, we remember that record-setting, pioneering flight on The Takeaway.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
If you're following the news, you may be asking yourself, what is going on in Myanmar or Burma? It's been more than a month since Cyclone Nargis hit that country. At least 80,000 people were killed. There are still tens of thousands that are missing. But what was the response to that disaster? We don't know because the insular government in Myanmar doesn't allow aid groups and the international community in to observe what's going on. But a New York Times reporter who we can't identify is live on the line with us from Myanmar. Foreign journalists are not allowed to operate freely there, so we're not going to identify him. But joining us now, tell us what appears to be some good news that was concealed by the Myanmar government about the response to the aftermath of the cyclone.
I guess it's hard to, you know, categorize it as good news when 130,000 people, or probably that number, died in the cyclone. But, I mean, there were great fears just after the cyclone, as you say, because everything was shrouded in such secrecy, that there could be a second wave of deaths, that there could be outbreaks of disease, that there could be starvation in these pockets of, in these remote areas of the Irrawaddy River Delta, where the cyclone struck. And, you know, for a number of factors, it turns out that you know, looks like that didn't happen. And it looks like the number of people who died waiting for aid, who were severely injured and couldn't get medical attention, you know, who were so lacking for food and water that they died. It looks like that number is very, very small. And the reasons are, one, the hardiness of the people in that part of Myanmar. They're used to being on their own, not getting much assistance. They're fishermen, They're farmers. They know how to live off the land. And it turns out that the storm as well, the character of the storm, meant that a lot of people died, a lot of people drowned, but they didn't cause many severe injuries like we saw in the Chinese earthquake, for instance.
One of the things you chronicle in your story in the New York Times is how resilient the population has been in setting up aid networks to deliver, medical and food aid to people in the civilian population, partially because people in Myanmar aren't used to, or they've long ago given up on expecting anything from their government.
Well, this is one of sort of the untold stories here, which might never get told because the people who carried it out don't really want publicity. It might lead to the government could be angry about it. I mean, angry, about what they did. I mean, in the first few days after the cyclone, the government was very wary of having private citizens in Myanmar hand out aid, travel down to the Delta and hand out aid. They often said it has to go through us. They confiscated rice. They confiscated clothing that people were handing out. And there was a lot of anger welling up because of that, and the government basically backed off. People left in huge convoys. We're talking about businessmen and doctors and just anyone with a heart in Yangon, a commercial capital. They left in these huge convoys for the Delta, and they handed out tons and tons of food, tons and tons of clothing. They didn't reach the most remote areas, but some of the international medical associations that were on the ground managed to reach those people. So it was a much greater coverage than of relief than we initially thought.
A story of anonymous heroes there in Myanmar, including our reporter, operating from somewhere inside the country, a New York Times reporter who we cannot name because reporters are not allowed to operate freely there. Thanks for joining us this morning. And now, more headlines from Femi Oke.
Hello there. About 8 minutes to the hour now. Just coming back to some of the stories we've been talking about this morning. There's a ceasefire between Israel and Gaza on the Gaza Strip, between Israel and the Palestinian group Hamas. That kicks into force on Thursday. Lebanon-Israel talks as well. That's upcoming. And also, as we look out towards Afghanistan, there is a military offensive against the Taliban forces around Kandahar. That's carrying on really as we speak. As to also is the flooding and the risk of flooding along the Mississippi River banks. Now, there are about 27 levees that are at risk of bursting, and National Guard troops and volunteers are actually stashing big sandbags out there trying to stop those levees from bursting. And again, that is an ongoing story, and a story that's pretty much over and done, but they're still partying in Boston. Boston Celtics, NBA champions 2008.
Perfect segue. Thank you very much, Femi. I want everyone to close their eyes and imagine they were in Boston last night and heard this.
There we go.
Celtics win it 131-92. And something we rarely see, maybe we've never seen, a Gatorade bath for an NBA coach. That kind of night for the Celtics. Kevin Garnett.
Cheers and hollers after the Celtics won the NBA championship for the first time in 22 years, and I'm not gloating. For Bostonians,
right,
the Celtics join the Red Sox and New England Patriots as recent world champions, and amid the celebrations is a glowing sense of pride that finally the NBA title has returned to its rightful home. Richard Johnson, it's a great day to be a Bostonian, huh?
It is, even on about 3 hours sleep.
Richard, can you talk about what this means to Boston to bring home the title again?
Well, it's sort of the restoration of the crown. There's been trophy has been in exile for 22 years, and it's back home again. The only thing missing last night was one Arnold Red Auerbach.
Reynold Arbach. Richard Johnson, I should say, is the curator for the Boston Sports Museum, which is located in the Boston Garden.
Yes, indeed.
And so, had they sent you the ball yet?
No, but I'm making some phone calls this morning. I didn't make any beforehand because I'm very superstitious and I didn't want to do anything to jinx them.
All right, let's talk about the tradition in Boston. You're talking about hardcore fans. They don't tend to be fair weather fans. They root for their team when they're up and when they're down. And this was a real bringing together of some of the traditional figures. Talk about who was at the game.
Oh, my Lord. Havlicek and Russell, JoJo White, ML Carr, and Danny Ainge, of course, the architect of this year's championship, was a member of two of them himself as a player. Not only were the alumni in the building, but I think the ghosts were there too.
So, Richard, what's wrong? You couldn't find any real celebrities? What's the problem? You know what I mean?
Well, it's sort of the difference between pyrite and gold, and last I checked, we had the gold here, not the fool's gold.
That's a good answer.
You can't handle the truth.
You guys are making jokes about who would have been in the L.A. audience had
very
the game
different.
Been L.A.
Yeah.
and the Lakers had won. You
well, Magic
been
Johnson
about
would have been there.
Celebrities.
Magic Johnson would have been there if the Lakers had won. But anyway, Richard, that's amazing the difference between the character in the Boston Garden and virtually anywhere else on the basketball court in the NBA.
Yeah, although I must say, in New York, there will be a similar celebration at some point. I couldn't tell you when. I don't have that crystal ball. But the fact is that it means a lot here because every day you're in the building, you look up, and there were those 16 flags flying there, almost as sort of a challenge to everyone in the building, not just the team, but, you know, standards were not being lived up to for a while. And this ownership group now that's been in for about half a dozen years had both the foresight and maybe some would say the hubris to name their corporate entity Banner 17. Well,
they could do no wrong this year.
It's being stitched right now as we're speaking.
Foresight and hubris. Thank you, Richard Johnson. Richard Johnson is the curator of the Boston Sports Museum in the Boston Garden.
Banner 17. Well, we'll see
yes.
if there's an 18. We'll
yes.
see if there's an 18.
Well, let's just enjoy.
Could you try
let's
to be objective?
Just enjoy
Could you just
this,
try
and
to
also
be objective?
We can enjoy the conversations that are continuing on
yep.
our website at thetakeaway.org. And here's one about this really harsh weather, the unforgiving weather. Bradley writes to us, wacky weather is increasingly about social justice. The biggest challenge cities will face is one focused on the development of strategies to better manage the needs of climate refugees, he's got that in quotes, who will increasingly move north.
A lot of people are talking about whether climate change is related to the weather. There's also people talking about women pioneers. That was the takeaway question for today. I immediately thought of American-born Lisa Hullaby, who became Jordan's Queen Noor in a quiet and dignified manner. Queen Noor brought increasing opportunities for education and participation in the economy of Jordan. When you look around the Middle East, Jordan remains a beacon of hope for their women of all socioeconomic strata, especially compared with their sisters in other Arab nations. Thanks for sending that.
Yeah, so we love to hear from you, as always, about anything on the program, and especially today about women who you consider pioneers. What have they done? How have they influenced your lives? You can always give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can write to us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. John?
There's a blog from political director Andrea Bernstein on our website, also a robust conversation about the value of Al Gore's endorsement of Barack Obama. You can find all of that at thetakeaway.org.
Bye-bye.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.